welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 292 of the podcast. Today, I have an interview with Chris Fox, and we're talking about how to use data science to create and sell more books. Now, I have previously been skeptical of this right-to-market approach, but after the bestseller code, which I talked about a few weeks ago, and also I'm considering my own writing plans for 2017 at the moment, so I'm starting to take this quite seriously, mainly because I've written a lot of books that have been on my heart, and some of them have fallen straight through the genre gaps. The London Psychic trilogy is a good example. It just doesn't fit into particular genre. So I'm really determined to try and overlap the type of books I love with a voracious market. And Chris has some really good information on this. I enjoyed our conversation, and we are both techie geeks, really, and also futurist geeks. And we're both very positive about how technology will help authors with writing and marketing. Neither of us are scaremongers about the future. We are the happy, positive AI lot. So I will definitely be having Chris back on the show at some point over the years as we move into more technological stuff. But Chris's new book, Six Figure Author, might not be out yet as this airs, as these are all our pre-recorded sessions, but it will be out soon. So keep an eye out for it. And of course, Chris has Right to Market out as well, and some other books, which we talk about in the interview. So, as I mentioned, this is another pre-recorded introduction. And as this airs, I will be in Portland, Oregon, after leaving the West Coast, where I've been attending a masterclass workshop with Dean Wesley Smith, Christine Catherine Rush in Lincoln City for the last week. So keep an eye on the blog and on Twitter for my lessons learned. This week, I'm heading back to Denver because my flight's out of there. And then I'm back to London and then on to Tel Aviv in Israel for a few days on the beach, hopefully warming up. It's like west coast of Oregon to the Mediterranean coast of Israel. I'm really hoping to warm up and maybe avoid the rain for a couple of weeks. Avoid the rain maybe for a couple of weeks, but a couple of days on Tel Aviv beach before the next couple of weeks, I'll be touring around various Holy Land sites, which will appear in my next novel, End of Days, the ninth book in the Arcane series. So super exciting. And if you want to see any pictures from Israel, I will generally be posting those at facebook.com/JFPenAuthor. So I tend to share, you know, anything that goes into my fiction on my author page. I also have a site, jfpen.com/now, N-O-W, and I keep that as kind of a diary of what I'm up to with my fiction. So there will be, depending on when you listen to this, the album, the photo album, any videos I do will be at jfpen.com/now. Other things this week, just a reminder about the Pulse Pounders Thriller Bundle. Pay what you like, super deal, filled with amazing thrillers from people like me and Kevin J. Anderson and Jonathan Mabry, Dean Wesley Smith, and a whole load of other authors, available at thecreativepen.com/bundle, B-U-N-D-L-E. So go and check that out if you like a fast-paced read. So again, no tweets or emails this week as this is pre-recorded, but I will be responding to you directly if you tweet me at The Creative Pen or email me joanna@thecreativepen.com, and we'll have a mega roundup when I get back. So today's episode is sponsored by everyone who supports the show on Patreon. You guys are so awesome with your support that I've been able to move to only one corporate sponsor per month, which of course is Kobo, who you hear every second episode pretty much these days. So the list of everyone supporting the show on Patreon is at thecreativepen.com/patrons. And on each of those, I link to whatever I can find. But But if you need your link changed, please email alexandra@thecreativepen.com. And Alexandra, my VA, will get that link updated. So if you want a link back to your website, all you have to do is sponsor the Creative Pen podcast on Patreon. So thank you so much to everyone. And of course, if you do support the show, you even just $2 a month or whatever you like, you will get that extra monthly Q&A audio, of which there is now a whole year's worth of backlist extra. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Chris Fox. Hi Chris.
Hi Joanna, thanks for having me on.
Oh no, it's great to finally have you on after we met earlier this year. So just a little introduction. Chris is the best-selling author of science fiction and dark fantasy, as well as non-fiction books for authors, including Right to Market, 5,000 Words Per Hour. And today we're talking about his next book, Six-Figure Author, Using Data to Sell Books. And these are pretty good book titles as well, Chris. Your SEO is pretty good too.
Yeah, I definitely have very clickbaity titles.
You do. And we're going to get into that because, you know, people, you know, I've talked before about how I don't write to market, but we're going to talk about this a bit later. But first of all, I want to just find out a bit more about you. Why do you care about data science as well as writing? So tell us a bit more about your own background and how these topics connect in your own life.
Sure. It's really integral to who I am professionally. Back in 2010, I worked in collections at a credit union making just above minimum wage and really disliked the job. I mean, I was the guy that would call and say, hey, your car payment is late. So you can imagine how people reacted to me on the phone. And I was desperate to escape that situation. Right around that time, the iPad was released. And I sort of had this epiphany where I looked at the iPad and I realized that the people who could make applications for the iPhone and the iPad were going to make a ton of money because in the next 5 years, everyone would have one. So I invested several thousand dollars I didn't have. And I used that money to buy a new Mac and the software that I needed to teach myself to develop these applications. And if you fast forward just a couple of years, I ended up moving to San Francisco, where I got a job at a startup. And this is where I first started learning about data science. So what I didn't know at the time is San Francisco is actually the real tech hub of the world. I thought it was Silicon Valley. But everybody from Uber to Fitbit to PayPal to Square to LinkedIn, they're all within a couple of miles of the same financial district, either north or south of Market. And so when you're going to lunch, everybody wears their hoodies or their t-shirts, kind of like uniforms, and there's the PayPal guys and the Square guys. And everybody likes to talk about what they're working on. And what people were working on in 2012 and 2013 was data science. And the company that I landed at, Cellscope, we created a microscope that would attach to your smartphone so that you could record an ear exam and then broadcast that up to a doctor. And we took it a step further and started using machine learning so that instead of needing to ask a doctor whether or not your ear was infected, the app could actually tell you, hey, listen, that's the tympanic membrane. I can see your eardrum and I'm pretty sure you've got AOM.
Wow. Okay. Which is cool. So then how do we get from an app to diagnose your ear stuff to books?
So at the same time that I'm learning all this data science, which is fascinating for me, I'm a JC dropout. I never finished my college degree, and I'm surrounded by people with doctorates from like Stanford and Berkeley. And as they're teaching me this stuff, I put out my first book, No Such Thing as Werewolves. And like every other author out there, I refresh my KDP dashboard like 40 times a day. And I spend, you know, hours checking out my product page. And something began to crystallize. I began to realize that Amazon was using data science so that what I saw was not the same thing that a coworker might see or a friend might see or my family might see. Amazon was dynamically generating content for every single user that came to their site. So that started to lead me into, well, how is data science being used for writing? And it occurred to me, Amazon's been doing this quietly in the background for almost 15 years where they're gathering all this data. So I started to realize that if I could use the system they had created, I might be able to sell more books. And unsurprisingly, I guess, it worked.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in a minute. So let's just stick with some definitions. So what is machine learning? So people know that. I mean, many people have heard about the algorithms, and of course, we don't know what the algorithms do necessarily, but we can take some educated guesses. So what is machine learning, algorithms, all these types of things?
So machine learning is exactly what it sounds like. It's machines that can learn. They're capable of learning new things. You teach a computer program what it's supposed to know about, and then it tries to get smarter and smarter at whatever that thing is. So the best easy example I can think of is if you've used Facebook and you uploaded a photo, you know how it draws a little box around your face? Well, how does it know to do that? How does it know where the face is in the image? And that's machine learning. And what what Facebook did to achieve that is they created a classifier, and they taught that classifier, okay, this is what a nose looks like, this is what eyes look like, this is what your mouth looks like, and if you find all of them and they're in this arrangement, you found a face. And then they fed in maybe, let's say, 100,000 images with the square already drawn around where the face was, and their baby algorithm, we'll call it an artificial intelligence, it's not quite there, but it's getting there, looked at all that data and figured out, okay, this is how faces look. I've seen literally millions of them now, and it gets smarter and smarter at identifying where in the image that face is. And so that's the only thing that this AI is capable of doing. But they're building lots of different little interlocking AIs called classifiers that work together to do pretty much anything you can think of.
I know some people will be getting lost already, but we're going to try and keep and hold it together. Now, Amazon also kind of hire it out, don't they? Because I use Amazon S3 to host mm-hmm. this podcast, for example, and S3 is like the cloud hosting. And in fact, I think a massive proportion of Amazon revenue now comes from hosting a lot of the internet on the Amazon servers. But they also do, you can now hire their machine learning services, can't you, in the same way that I kind of use their servers. So what's the difference between what they use for books and like what you can actually rent yourself?
So Amazon is at its heart a data company, and they've built a number of tools. So think of this like a toolbox that a data scientist could pick up, where I could make my own hammer and I could make my own wrench, or I could pay Amazon to use the things they've already created, including the hardware where you need to do all the number crunching. There's a lot of very intense CPU work needed on these computers. So Amazon spun off this division, Amazon Web Services, which we used at the company, the startup that I worked at as well, to host all our stuff. And they really have made it accessible so that almost anybody, if they've got a data scientist or two, a teeny little startup, can use what they've created and start figuring out, again, almost anything that you can imagine, how to, you know, diagnose ears being the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't program, but I would kind of love to use the Amazon AI stuff to try and figure out how we can automate your system. But well, let's go further into that. So let's first talk about how does Amazon differ from iBooks, Kobo, Nook, other retailers in how they use this type of machine learning?
So iBooks, Kobo, and Nook, what they all have in common is they work very much like a real brick and mortar bookstore. A person is deciding what books they're going to promote, where those are going to show up, and how long they're going to be there. And that's very carefully curated by those companies. So if you have a relationship with Apple, the people at iBooks are great, then they're going to help you out and they're going to put your book where it can be seen by its target audience. What Amazon does, it's more of, I guess, a meritocracy, where their data science is figuring out which books are selling, and then in the background, they're showing those books to more people without you needing to do anything at all. So Amazon is much more adept at using data science to locate the target audience for any given product. And it's just books, but you know, and everything from surfboards to televisions are sold using the same algorithms.
Yeah, so now my ears pricked up there, and I know people listening will. So sharing information about your book or pushing your book without you having to do anything.
And yes.
Yeah, now everyone's like, oh my goodness, how do we make this work? Because let's face it, this is already there. It's already in Amazon. And a lot of people are going to a lot of effort to try and sell more books by pushing traffic, for example, to the system. So how can we use the AI? I mean, you use the phrase, how can we train Amazon's system to sell more books for us? So without us having to do so much marketing.
So this is easier to do if you've written a book to market, but it's not necessary to write a book to market to make this work. What you want to do is figure out with as much accuracy as possible who your target audience is. And when you start selling your book, the number of sales is not nearly as important as who you sell your book to, because each of those sales to Amazon represents a customer profile. So if you can convince them that people who voraciously read in your genre are going to love this book, and you sell, let's say, a couple of hundred copies to people like that, Amazon's going to take it and run with it. You've now successfully trained them about who your audience is because you used good data, and now they're able to easily sell your book. If, on the other hand, you know, your mom buys a copy, and, you know, your friend at the coffee shop buys a copy, and people who aren't necessarily into that genre are all buying it, Amazon gets really lost and confused. So the beauty of how this works is that as an author, all you really need to do is figure out who your audience is and sell a few books to them, and Amazon will do the rest.
Yeah. And again, everything we're saying is like, yeah, figure out who your audience is. So I just want to come back there to something like PermaFree. So, you know, I've been doing this since like 2009, really, when my first books, you know, when the Amazon went international, when Amazon KDP went international. Before then, it was only for Americans back in the old days. But, you know, the PermaFree first in series has been kind of an evergreen marketing tactic that a lot of people have used, myself included. And I know some people are now saying, you know, maybe that has fallen off. Others are saying it hasn't. Now, what we know with a PermaFree and when we promote a PermaFree is that a whole load of people who pick up free books will pick up the PermaFree. So are you basically saying that a PermaFree with, say, a BookBub on a free book is a bad thing? Because even though you might shift 10,000 copies, maybe 9,000 of those people are not the people that you want the algorithm to know about.
Exactly. And you can test this yourself. Let's say you've had a BookBub in the last 6 months. How long was the tail? Because if it was the right kind of data, you're going to see that your book is sustaining its sales rank. It's going to keep selling once it hits a certain level. But if you have the wrong type of audience, that'll manifest both in your also bot, where you'll see that you have cookbooks mixed in with your romance novels or whatever genre it is that you're writing. And I think that that can be really dangerous, because once that data is polluted, if you give away those 10,000 copies to a bunch of random people, Amazon will never again have any idea how to sell your book.
Yeah, and actually, I had a look today at something it's not even my PermaFree, but it's got a blooming Russian book, a book in Russian on the first page of my people who, or, you know, bought this also bought this. And I was just like, that's crazy, because I was having a look at it for our conversation. So that was kind of nuts. Okay, so, and I know now people are going, oh no, that's terrible. So is therefore a 99-cent promotion better with a more targeted audience, and you know, what would be the best ways to do that according to the system that you're mentioning?
Absolutely. I think that a targeted 99-cent sale is going to get you a lot more mileage, or just doing sustained advertising. So $5 or $10 a day with Amazon or Facebook or AdWords, whatever your advertising platform of choice is, make sure you're hitting whatever your target audience is, and you're going to get a trickle of sales. But 99-cent sales have worked great for me. When I released Destroyer, I put it out there at 99 cents. It sailed all the way up to number 200 in a store, because that 99 cents kind of removes the barrier of purchase, and a lot more people are going to pick it up during that window.
Yeah, I've heard a few things recently that make me really on the edge of removing my PermaFree. And it's kind of like, oh, it's difficult, because that's something, you know, we tend to like the things that have worked for us in the past. But, you know, one of the reasons to talk to you is to challenge myself around what I do. You know, I like to think I'm a futurist, and we'll talk about that. But gosh, I find myself sticking with things that have worked in the past, whereas we both know how fast things change in this market.
It's really difficult, and I face the same dilemma. So I went wide with my books in, I want to say, April of 2015, and I had a PermaFree first in series, and it did pretty well, and that was working for a while. But then a friend of mine, Rick Gulteri, writes, I think Build a Vampire is the name of his series, and he had it wide, and he pulled it back in December into Kindle Unlimited, and his sales tripled in about 2 weeks. So I've been watching him, and I watched for several months as all of a sudden he's having five-figure months. I'm like, So I finally got over my reticence to remove my books from the other retailers. I put them into Kindle Unlimited, and sure enough, as soon as I did that, I started making a lot more money.
Oh, you know, of course, I hate to hear that because I am one of these people who is really into going wide, mainly because in 2008, you know, I got laid off along with loads of other people in the GFC and I swore never to rely on one company again. And I know that you are really hardcore for KDP Select now. And you mentioned Amazon ads. And of course, you can't use Amazon ads unless you're in KDP Select, which is super annoying. Now, I'm thinking that I will write something new, like a different series that would be in Select, as opposed to pulling my other books, because I'm very committed to Kobo, who sponsored the podcast, and iVoox. And, you know, I think we, on a much bigger level, we should be investing in building an ecosystem. And also in other countries, some of these other stores are stronger. So how are you feeling? I mean, right now you've pulled them, as you say. Is that just a short-term strategy?
It is. It is absolutely a short-term strategy. Like you, I'm terrified of having all my eggs in one basket, which is why I went wide with my books originally. I mean, it's scary because Amazon could decide tomorrow they're killing off KDP or they're cutting our royalties in half or whatever they're going to do. And if you're solely reliant on them, you're really in trouble. This kind of gets back to the data science, why I'm willing to do this short-term risk. I get probably 15 to 20% of my sales coming back as mailing list subscribers by using the technique that Nick teaches about reader magnets. I actually learned it on the Creative Pen, putting that in the front and back batter of my book. So by selling a ton of books on Amazon in the short term, I'm building up this really engaged, large list of people that I can use at places like Facebook or Google for advertising. So when I'm prepared to go back wide, now I've got this massive audience that I can take with me. And that, I think, makes it worth it. But it is still a little scary because you never know what's going to happen with Amazon.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of this is to do with backlist and having a number of books. So just briefly, just tell us about Destroyer and what you did with these right to market books.
So I did something I called the 21-day novel challenge, and I wrote and edited this book in 3 weeks. I sent it to a line editor who gave it a quick look and sent it right back. And then a week after that, it was live on Amazon. And the goal there was to write a book that would sell really well. I was gambling that it would get into the top 1,000, excuse me, which it successfully did. It got all the way up to number 200, sold 500 plus copies the first day, and it stayed there for months. So for the first 60 days of Destroyer's launch, Amazon ended up pushing the book largely through Kindle Unlimited. And I was just selling thousands upon thousands of copies and having millions of pages read. So that book sustained its rank for far longer than I expected it to. And when it started to fall, I put up the sequel and the same thing happened. And when it started to fall again, I put up the third book. So here we are 5 months after I released Destroyer. Destroyer is still probably number 3,000-ish in the store. And to date, the series has earned me about $65,000.
Yeah. So why did you write those books? So let's get into the kind of write the market thing. So why did you decide to write the Destroyer? Talk a bit more about what Destroyer is and why you decided to write that genre.
Sure. I chose this genre because it's an intersection between where I know there's a large, voracious audience of readers. They're going to go ahead and buy this book in droves because there's so many of them out there and they love science fiction. And it also is something that I enjoy writing. So growing up, I watched a lot of science fiction movies. I've always read sci-fi books. And I knew that if I could find that intersection, if I could get to a point where I was writing something that had a massive audience, my book being very similar to other books that were in that genre already, I'd have a really high likelihood of selling to the same audience of people that liked the books that were already out.
Saving. Okay. So, which is very cool. So the important thing, and this is why I think when people hear right to market, and I know you can't, it's like Tim Ferriss with the 4-hour work week. Everyone goes, oh, but I bet you work more than 4 hours. And the same with right to market. You know, you actually do say in the book, you have to start from where you love because, you know, and then find the intersection of a genre within that that is selling well. So, and I'm going to explain how I followed your thing in a minute, but how do you find a subcategory or, you know, a smaller niche within the Amazon ecosystem? What are the things to look for in order to find a voracious readership?
So what I do is I start looking at the rankings of the number one, the number 20, 40, 60, 80, and 100 books. And you can tell based on where those books are ranked, how many books in the genre are selling. So if the number one book is ranked in the top 100 in the store, and so is the 20th book, then you found one of the hottest genres on Amazon. If you find that by the time you get down to number 40, the rank is dropping off sharply, that suggests that not enough books are being produced in that genre, and it might be a great place for you to jump in and make a name for yourself.
Yes. Yeah, so I had a look. So basically, you know, the reason I wanted to talk to you about this is I've written this London Psychic trilogy. The first book of that series is Desecration, totally written from my heart. Really a book that I had an idea, I wrote it, and I still struggle to sell these books because they should have been straight crime, but there's a psychic in them. They're kind of an edge of horror. They're quite, you know, the bit of supernatural. They literally don't fit anywhere. And of course my Arcane series is action adventure and sells quite well in action adventure. But this London Psychic trilogy, I'm like, I can't find a place for it. So I went through and identified the things about my books that were interesting. And I wanted to tell people the numbers. So I looked for subcategories that had that the number one was around 200. In total, and the number 20 was around 5,000. So would you say those are sort of the right numbers?
That's a great spread. That means that the top books in that genre are selling extremely well. You can make a great living, but they bottom out pretty quickly. So there's not, you know, hundreds of new books coming out every week.
Yeah. Okay. Which is cool. And so I basically found British horror fiction. which is really funny because British horror fiction, I read a lot of James Herbert and people might remember him from the 80s, but I really love James Herbert and he really is a British horror fiction writer. Now, I don't like, you know, really violent stuff like gore, but because anything with sort of supernatural that's not paranormal goes in horror, basically. So you helped me with this. You basically said I should have a look at, and we sort of narrowed it down to ghosts and haunted houses and British horror. So we found that subgenre, and that does fit with the books I love and also a genre that is more hungry. So what happens next if people have gone through this? Because obviously, and the reason I'm sharing this is there won't be many people listening who will be interested in this subgenre. To be fair, it's not like military sci-fi or anything in romance. So what's next? If you've identified your subcategory, what do you do?
So if you think you've identified your subcategory, the next thing to do is to buy between 3 and 5 of the top selling books, ideally ones that are written by indies, and then read the books. See what they're doing in these books. What tropes are they using? What conventions do they have to stick to? How long are the books? How frequently do they release? What do the covers look like? What are the blurbs? And just kind of digest all that information to get a feel for how and why the books in that genre are selling. And even if you don't consciously consider that when you're writing your own book, all that's going to kind of lurk in your subconscious and you're going to write something similar by nature.
Yeah, and it's funny because I know, again, a lot of people will be resistant to this. I've been resistant to this until I'm like, I'm just annoyed about not being able to find a place for my other books. And also, I'm coming to the end of a nine book cycle and I'm ready to write something new. So I was really thinking, what do I want to write? So let's just revisit the idea of tropes and conventions. So these are things like, you know, a James Herbert stuff will have a demonic presence that will, you know, a kind of religious edge. It's not Christian fiction, so it's not like spiritual warfare, but there's a demonic presence in some way that is oppressing people, and that it's a good versus evil fight, basically. That's one of the horror tropes that I love about Stephen King and other things. Now, that doesn't mean that I can't use my own creativity, does it? So I'm not going to write exactly the same book or haunted houses, of course, are a big deal, or an evil presence in a particular place, and being in pagan England, you know, there's loads of this stuff. So people will be resistant over creativity versus tropes, so maybe you could comment on that.
It's really just a framework for the book that you're writing. So regardless of whether or not you write a book to market or you're just writing something from your heart, you're probably writing to a fairly specific genre set of conventions. Like, I love fantasy. Most of my author friends love epic fantasy. And so the epic fantasies that we've been tinkering on, quite by accident, already follow a lot of the writing to market advice. So it shouldn't be that hard for you to follow story concepts, because you don't need to look at them exactly and mimic completely, you know, the same demonic presence that you saw in this other book. You should come up with your own protagonist and antagonist. They should be very, very unique. You just want to use the same broad brushstrokes that were used in other novels. So I've got the aging starship and I have the Maverick captain, but all the details of that universe and the people in it and the enemies that they're fighting, that's all unique to me, stuff that I made up from scratch.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. And as you say, you know, my Arcane series, the type of Dan Brown, people who read like Dan Brown, you know, there's religious artifacts and there's archaeologists and Indiana Jones style, Lara Croft style. You know, we do read in specific genres often. So these are the things we like to write. So I definitely agree with that. And so then I wanted to, okay, so then we write the book, obviously.
Well, there are a couple other steps I do before you write it. Yeah. I would read the reviews of the other books that are out and see what people had to say, both the one stars and the five stars, because that's going to tell you a lot about reader expectations. The people who are giving it a five star are going to tell you what that person did right. And the one stars are going to say, this is kind of where they messed up. And you'll learn a lot when you're crafting your plot about what you can and can't get away with in that genre. And then once you've done that kind of research, yeah, it's time to jump in and plot your book.
Yeah, and again, this is great. And I tend to not look at my one star reviews because it makes me depressed. But I actually caught sight of one on Audible for the London Psychic, one of the London Psychic books. And it said, Dennis Wheatley meets Barbara Cartland. Now, if people don't know who those two authors are, Dennis Wheatley is a massive horror writer from, you know, I want to say the 60s, 70s. And Barbara Cartland's obviously massive romance author. And it was a one star review and it made me laugh so much because it's kind of an emotional horror book. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I clearly just totally got the category wrong. Somehow it ended up with somebody who's read the book who's not the right audience. So what you're basically saying is if you research that category and read the reviews, you can see what people hate about
exactly.
things and also what they love.
What they expect.
Mm-hmm. And what they expect. So let's circle back to the data science. How does this all kind of fit in to what we started out talking about in terms of Amazon's algorithms? Why will this approach make it more successful?
Because if you understand these people, this audience that is reading a certain type of book, and you get kind of why they're reading those books and what they're getting out of them, then you can very easily craft a story that will provide those things. And if you do that, and if you have a genre-appropriate cover that's similar to the other top-selling books in your genre, Amazon's going to start showing that to all the people who bought these books. This is where Kindle Unlimited becomes wonderful, because there are so many voracious readers who read 7 to 10 books a week and they'll run out of books. So they're always looking for something new. And if you show them your new book that looks very similar to these other books and kind of hits the same notes, then they're going to buy it, they're going to devour it, love it, review it, and they're going to ultimately sign up to your mailing list.
Okay, so let's. So we've written the book now, and it hits the right emotional notes. And then when we publish it, we put it under the subcategories that we identified. Then, are you using? Let's talk about Amazon ads, because I'm not somebody who currently uses them. What is so good about Amazon ads for? And maybe explain what they are for people who don't use them. Why are they so good for this type of approach?
So not Amazon ads specifically, but any types of ads. Amazon ads differ a little bit from Facebook in that you can use more targeted keywords. So when you're setting up an Amazon ad, you can add as many keywords as you want of different types, and you will pay a certain bid based on which keywords are clicked. And what Amazon does is they show a row of sponsored ads right under the also bot on the product page. So that's where you're showing up. And what this can lead to is a bunch of impressions across Amazon where people who are looking at other, in my case, science fiction books, are seeing my sponsored book down there on that same page. And some of them are going to click on it. It's not always profitable. I've lost money. I've broken even at different points. The longer I do it, the more profitable it gets. But you know, I'm not doing it so much because it makes direct money, but because I'm getting people who are in the right target audience. I want it shown to people who love science fiction, and I'm willing to pay a premium for that. You don't necessarily need to do that with Amazon ads. You can also do it with Facebook ads. I know that, you know, Mark Dawson taught that course. One of the big things that Mark Dawson really harped on was making sure you have your audience right and make sure that you're constantly experimenting. And this is the reason why. Mm-hmm. If you get your audience kind of zeroed in to a point where you're marketing to the right people, it automatically becomes more profitable. And you don't have to do a lot of it, $5, $10 a day. But if you're hitting that right audience, you get the trickle of sales enough to trigger Amazon's algorithms.
Yes. And I think I need to find some alive authors since James Herbert is dead. And it's interesting because like Stephen King and James Patterson are too mainstream, I think, for this type of approach. When if you try and use James Patterson on Facebook ads, for example, even though it might perform well, he's such a wide market with so many different products. Like he does YA, he does romance, he does thrillers, he does all kinds of things. So he would be too big, wouldn't he? So do people really need to kind of identify specific authors? Like you said, indies, but indies aren't always on Facebook as targets.
Right. And it's not always an option that you can use. So it's a little harder, I find, with Facebook advertising to find the right audience. And it takes a lot more experimentation. I've lost a lot more money on Facebook ads than I've made. but I never gave it the time and attention, I think, that Mark Dawson has. And now the further into my career I get, the more I can see why he's doing what he's doing. I think it is really just experimentation, and it depends on your genre. In the case of Amazon ads, because you can do more targeted keywords, you don't necessarily have to say James Patterson. You could find one of his books, like, say, Zoo, and use that as your keyword. And like James Patterson Zoo would be a keyword. And that would probably get you a little bit more traction because it's more targeted.
Okay. So I wanted to then, I mentioned, it will be a few weeks ago now when this goes out, but I mentioned this new book called The Bestseller Code, which has been doing the rounds on the publishing news sites, which talks about machine learning to analyze books. And actually, I read it and talked a bit about it on the show, so I won't go into too much. But basically, they found The Da Vinci Code and 50 Shades of Grey have exactly the same story arc, and actually they plotted it on a graph. It was exactly the same, and those two books obviously are very different. The Hunger Games, again, you know, this type of story arc. Now, I don't think that's anything new, because we know that from the story grid. It absolutely fits the arch plot thing. That's not new stuff. But what is new is they're using machine learning to analyze books. And my first thought was, I want access to that because I want to load my manuscript up and see how it maps against a story of a bestseller like The Da Vinci Code, for example. And there are other companies that are doing this now, and I talked a bit about that at the Smart Artist Summit. But what are your thoughts on these types of tools that are analyzing story? Are publishers going to use that for the slush pile? Is Amazon using that already? What do you think about this bestseller code thing?
I think that Amazon probably is using this already, and I think it's going to grow over time. It's in its infancy, so it's not really powerful yet. But you give this 5-10 years, and it's going to revolutionize how books are sold, because we're going to understand more about how stories work. Amazon knows a whole bunch of metrics they're not showing us, things like most people will get to page 218 in this book, and then they stop. Imagine if you as the author had access to that data. So you know that for some reason, nobody makes it past the 30th chapter of your book. I mean, how would that empower your career? You'd be able to figure out, oh gosh, I did A, B, or C in this chapter, and then go back and modify your own writing accordingly. So once tools are released that give us more information as authors, I think it's going to help us grow as writers, and we're going to know and learn a lot more about how we can improve.
But what do you say to people who might be scared about it? Like, oh, the AIs are going to win the Pulitzer next. And there are already companies writing nonfiction books, particularly with these, narrative science, I think, is one of them. And, they're doing journalism. Are writers going to be put out of business because the machines will do it?
I think you're at least a decade out before you have to worry about that, maybe two. And maybe never. There's always going to be a certain amount of creativity involved in the art that we're doing. And a computer can simulate that to a point. But in the same way that Michael Bay's movie have a certain style. You're going to see that from, I think, machine-created stories. They're going to be, especially in the beginning, a little bit more formulaic and a little bit less unique. And that's something we as authors are always going to be able to tap into. So I don't know that it's going to reach a point, maybe even in our lifetimes, where we have to worry about being out of a job. And if we do reach that point, odds are good a lot of other jobs got outsourced first.
No, that is true. And I know, you know, both you and I are not scared of this. We're looking forward to it in that, you know, I particularly would like an AI research assistant. So, for example, today I was writing and I was trying to find, synchronicity happens, as you know, when you write a novel. And I found this, I was trying to find a picture of the Egyptian goddess Wadjet, which is the cobra that's on the crown, the Uraeus crown. And I wanted a picture in a tomb in the Valley of Kings that I could use in my book that actually existed. So I spent ages looking at photos of the Valley of Kings, trying to zoom in and trying to, because I've been there, but I didn't look for that at the time. So I was like, oh, where is the picture? And about an hour later, I found an actual tomb that would work so that I could literally write the tomb. This is the type of writing I do, actually write the actual tomb number where this painting is, because I like reality in my fiction. So that took me so long. And I was thinking about our interview and I just thought, if I had an AI assistant, I would just go find me that. Now, that is that just glorified Google? I don't know. What do you think about that type of tool that an author could use?
Oh, I can't wait to have that. And I think that we absolutely will. And in the next several years, you're going to see more of that. As the tools that are being created get smarter, they'll be able to handle more of that heavy lifting. It'll get easier for you to do that kind of research. What excites me is really how this will enable kids to learn. So can you imagine having been 10 years old and having some sort of computer software program that could teach you storytelling and say, okay, your story's good, but maybe if you worked on this or we added that, and then all of a sudden, you know, you as a 10-year-old have produced a pretty decent story. I think that we're going to see that probably in the next decade, and it'll be really cool.
Yeah, that is a really good thought. And for those people who are worried about more and more books coming out, I always say to people, you know, how many more books do you read when you write books? Like, you know, before you were a writer, you still were a reader. But once you start writing, do you not read a ton more?
Mm-hmm. You should be if you're not.
Yeah, exactly. So if everybody in the world wrote a book, then everybody in the world would read a lot more books.
Right. So there's no loss there. There's just a gain for everybody who enjoys great fiction.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm glad we're both excited about that. But what I also, kind of circling back on technology that helps writers, you also have a book called 5,000 Words Per Hour. Now, today, I worked on my book for 2 hours. And because I spent so much time looking for that, I only wrote about 1,000 words in 2 hours. Now, so your book is 5,000 words per hour. Give us some tips for doing that, because obviously everyone wants to go and write to market now and do it fast.
So the first thing I would do is turn off the internet. You are not allowed to do any research when you are conducting your writing sprints. No research of any kind. Before you sit down to write, you want to make sure that the research is already done, that you have kind of your chapter summaries ready to go so you know what you're going to write. And then I would get a stopwatch or an Apple Watch or run a timer on your computer, whatever works easiest for you. But I would time that and do it in writing sprints. So you can find the time that works best for you. It can be 5 minutes, 10 minutes, a half hour. Some people do an hour. But when you're writing, you write straight through. You're not allowed to stop. You're not allowed to go back. You're not allowed to correct misspellings. You just crank out as many words as you can. And the problems that crop up in that prose are something you're going to fix in editing. And the reason you want to do this is forcing yourself into flow state gets easier and easier the more often you do these writing sprints. So initially it would take me 10 minutes to kind of reach that flow state where I stop thinking about writing and I'm just producing fiction. Now I can do that in probably 30 seconds. I sit down, I start the timer, and I start writing, and a couple of seconds later, out pours the prose. And ultimately, I think that's your goal, is to train your brain in the same way you want to train Amazon.
And you're using dictation as well, is that right?
I use it a lot less these days. So at the time that I wrote 5,000 words per hour, I was still working as a software engineer. So when I was standing at the bus stop, I'd be dictating into my phone. Now that I get to work from home all day, I generally prefer typing, but occasionally we'll still use dictation.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, my last book, I did a lot of dictation, and this one, I don't know why, but I'm just typing a lot more. I've only done a few thousand words dictation. And I think it's because I'm actually doing a lot of discovery writing in this book. Which I think when you get to book nine in a series kind of can happen. But it's really interesting that each book is a different type of project. But, are there any other things, I guess, if, you know, you've had the book Right to Market out for a while now, and I know you've had some kickback on, you know, people who haven't liked the concept, even though when you think about it, publishing editors, commissioning editors, that's basically what they do. They commission to market, don't they? They mm-hmm. buy the books they think will sell, like anything with a girl in the title, for example. So do you see that as being any different to the way a commissioning editor might work?
The big difference, I think, is how books are sold by traditional publishing. Because it takes a year to two to get that to market, it's really impossible for them to look at current market trends and figure out what they could write to market, just because the turn time on a traditional published novel is too long. So that kind of magic can't really be harnessed, and so they don't use it. And because that's been the case since the early 80s, I think we find that people are told not to write to a market because it won't be successful. Now, these days, we're heading back to where we were at in the 50s, where people would crank out massive amounts of pulp fiction. So if you look at, say, Isaac Asimov, he had over 500 published works in his lifetime, and he would crank out multiple short stories and occasionally a couple of novels in a month because he had to pay the rent. And there were all these publications that had picked him up.
Yeah, so, yeah. And he actually had, I believe, he had three typewriters in his mm-hmm. room, and he would, you know, he would always be typing a sentence on one book and another. It, like, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's so easy for us now with all the tools that we have. I can't even imagine having to have a typewriter and redo an entire page because I made a mistake.
No, and actually, Asimov is a good example. Enid Blyton's another one. She had over 500 books. I'm not going to put Barbara Cartland in there, although she was pretty prolific. But Isaac Asimov, because he spans pulp and classic, what people would call literary fiction, right? So, and I think one of the biggest issues that people have with the idea of writing fast and writing to market is that you won't write something with longevity. Now, I'm not saying quality, because we know quality is in the ears of the reader or whatever, but longevity, or writing something that you can say, this is the book I'm really proud of. So do you think that books that are written in this way can end up being these type of classics?
Absolutely. I think that you can do it quite by accident. So if you look at something like Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card, he wrote that book in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So you can really find that your best work can surprise you and can just leap out of nowhere. So if you're constantly writing and writing a lot, you never know which book is going to be the one that readers just absolutely love.
That's exactly right. And the second guessing is a nightmare. So, like, again, I'm struggling with this book because I'm second guessing it. I'm like, this is a really stupid idea. What am I doing with this snake thing that's going on? And that's because I'm overthinking it. And as you say, a lot of this is trusting. This is telling a story. It's meant to be fun, right?
Yeah, if we're not enjoying this, I mean, there's lots of easier jobs we could do in the world.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's cool. Okay, so anything else you're excited about, or that, you know, we can techie geek out on? AI, VR, but we're both into VR, aren't we?
Yes, I absolutely love where VR is going and how accessible it's coming. I've got an Oculus Rift, so I've used that a fair number of times. It comes with a simulation where you are sitting in the cockpit of a space shuttle and you're flying around the solar system. So you look this way and you can see the sun, and you look over here and there's Earth. So I'm not sure how that's going to manifest going forward, but I think that virtual reality is going to become a lot bigger in the next decade. And I'm really excited to see where that leads.
Yeah, no, me too. And at least I'll be doing this podcast in VR. I mean, I'll be like, okay, I'll meet you on Mars in VR, and we would do it there. I really think that will probably happen before fiction becomes easy to put into. I think having our worlds in VR is it will take a lot more, like having a movie made. You know, it's not something we'll be able to do necessarily on our own, but it will be more. Oh, I do have one more question before we finish up, circling back to the algorithms, because in my research on the British horror subgenre. I did my research on Amazon.com and I did some research on Amazon.co.uk. And there's some really, really different things happening on these two stores. And again, people will find the same if you try and publish something into Spanish. For example, we only have one KDP backend, and that is the same backend used for every single store. And the categories are even different. So that you will have different subcategories on .com as .co.uk as .es, for example, in Spain, like, or Germany. They don't seem to map. So what are your thoughts on how the hell they're doing that around, and how do we even, can we target different categories on Amazon.com and .co.uk, because when you load it up, there's no category there, for example.
Yeah, I see that as a problem, and I'm hoping it's something that Amazon addresses. In the meantime, I'm sort of taking the Pareto approach to it, the 80-20 approach. 80% of my sales come from the United States, so right now, at least, I'm targeting the United States, but the UK is growing, so is Australia. And they're different cultures and they have different categories. And I do want to find a way to tailor my message and the books that I'm putting out more to those audiences. And right now we just don't have it.
Yeah, even the covers, like one of the big things I want, and I keep asking the platforms, is I want to do a different cover for, say, Amazon India than I do for the UK or even for the US. Like, for example, the romance subgenre, the covers that you would have in America can be quite different to the UK covers that seem to resonate. And I think it's the same with some of these other categories, you know, that I know we're not selling massively in the Philippines yet. The Philippines is, you know, a bit more like India in terms of the colorful covers. Asia in general has more color, whereas, for example, British covers are duller, let's say.
More reserved.
Yeah, more reserved. And that, as you say, reflects the culture. So, I mean, whoever's listening, you know, obviously Amazon's going to go change their system. But I almost think we need an almost sub-KDP way to target these country-specific things like covers and keywords and categories.
Yeah, I think in time we're probably going to see those tools arise. I'd be really surprised if Amazon didn't address that in the next couple of years. But this is one of the downsides of being exclusive to Amazon. You're sort of at their mercy. So if they don't, I'm always going to be kind of fumbling when I'm selling overseas because I am using those American covers and I am using that, you know, description that's tailored to an American audience. So I really do hope they do something to address that. And there's definitely a need for it.
Absolutely. Okay, fantastic. That was really interesting. And we should probably do it again, like in a year's time, because I'm not writing these books anytime soon. But in a year, I should have something to say about it. Maybe I'll have some British horror ghost stories. Maybe I'm the next James Herbert, not the next Stephen King. But tell us, where can people find you and your books, your fiction and your nonfiction online?
So I have a YouTube channel, which is accessible through my website, chrisfoxwrites.com. It's got tutorial videos for writers. I also have articles on my site that are free if you're into marketing. As far as my books, most of them are only available on Amazon right now, but you can find links to them all on my website. Again, chrisfoxwrites.com.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time, Chris. That was great.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Joanne. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.